Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome to the second part of our look at technology and mental illness. This is Future Tense. Today, the efficacy of online self-help apps, and can personal data tracking be a useful aid to treatment? But before we go there, a reminder about some of the material we covered on last week's show.
We found basically a straight line. People who had the most social media use also had the most depression, and it was a statistically significant linear relationship. And it was a pretty substantial association as well. For example, those people who were in the top quartile with regard to social media use compared with those in the bottom quartile were about 2 to 3 times as likely to be depressed and to also be anxious.
We can't look at the longitudinal relationship between social media use and mood at this point in time because we don't have the studies that are following people and measuring their mental health over time to see whether or not there is a link. So currently the science still shows that although there may be a link there, the relationship is very weak and very small.
For a long time, I used to have these debates with people in other countries like Sweden and Denmark and the Netherlands, and they were doing blended or face-to-face therapies, and they were always finding that these online programs did worse. But now they're coming around to the fact that actually they're just as effective as face-to-face, which in itself raises some really interesting questions, doesn't it, about what technology can do and what people can do for themselves and also how they prefer to get their therapy.
You know, I think digital health offers a whole world of exciting new possibilities for people suffering with depression. One of the most exciting things is that it can bring in a lot of new information and clinical data about what is the lived experience, what is actually happening on a daily life, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day of people who are experiencing depression. Oftentimes, the way that we learn about as doctors and clinicians about depression is people come into the clinic visit and we ask them, how are you feeling? What have your symptoms been? How has the last month been? How has the last 3 months been? And the exciting part about this kind of behavioral digital health technology is we have the potential to capture a lot of exciting real-time data that may give us some clues about how people are feeling and how they're functioning in the real life in the community. You wanna disappear
in a crowd. And if you missed part one, don't forget you can still access the program as a podcast, or if you're in Australia, via the ABC Listen app. So the upshot is that there is evidence to suggest a link between social media usage and mental illness. But there are two quite significant caveats. One, that longitudinal research is still wanting. And two, well, it's the chicken and egg scenario. Does social media usage cause mental illness in some people? Or does pre-existing mental illness become more obvious and perhaps exacerbated through the use of social media? What was also clear was that many mental health professionals see a role for technology in dealing with mental illness. It can be part of the solution, not just the problem. As John Torres from Harvard Medical School mentioned in our last show, there are more than 10,000 commercial mental health apps available on the market, but only around 1% of those have been professionally evaluated.
There's very little research across the world being done on what makes a good app, how do we know it had a positive impact, how do we know that what the app says is true. A lot of times, many of these app studies are not as reproducible, or they'll find an interesting thing, but when other groups go back to kind of see does it reproduce on a different population at a different time, it doesn't always happen. So a lot of these apps yet don't have the strongest evidence base, and I think that's why it's important that we're seeing a lot more high-quality research coming out so we can know what is a good app and what could work well. I think something that sometimes also gets forgotten is a lot of these apps also can cause potential harm. And you say, well, how can an app, it sits on my smartphone in my pocket, how can that cause harm? Medications can cause harm. Those have side effects. They can make me feel unwell. But a lot of these apps, especially the ones that are free, if you say, why is the app free? Why is there no cost to download it? What happens is these apps are very careful to live outside of the medical realm. And by that, I mean they're very careful to live outside of kind of privacy laws that say what happens to medical data. So when you see a doctor, a therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, you know that there's protections for what you say. It's not going to be shared. It's not going to be sold. When you're downloading app, especially a mental health app that may be free, if you don't check the privacy policy, you may be surprised to learn what's happening to the data that you're telling the app. And a lot of these apps are free because you're telling the app perhaps what medication you're on, what therapy you're on, where you live, where you're going, what you're doing. And that information is being collected by the app, and the app will legally own it and can legally sell it to different parties that may be interested in your personal health information. So I think there's a lack of trust and transparency that's certainly an issue that the field also has to work on now, where I said people need to be confident that apps that they're using protect their personal mental health information.
So there are many potential benefits from the use of mental health apps, as well as reasons to be cautious. But how do you tell the good apps from the bad? Dr. Torres chairs the Working Group on Smartphone App Evaluation for the American Psychiatric Association. The association doesn't recommend specific apps, but it does provide guidance for consumers.
So what we've done, I said it, is actually publicly on the American Psychiatric Association webpage, we've made a four-step kind of guide that doesn't recommend any apps, but kind of helps people think through informed decision-making around the app. And what we recommend people do is they look at apps and discuss with their clinicians and together make a choice, but we say, make sure you consider the privacy and safety factors of an app, and we offer some questions to help stimulate decision-making. And we say, if you think it's going to be a safe and private app, look at the evidence. And we realize, as you said, not every app is going to have evidence, but at least make sure that the app is going to do what it claims or the theories it's based on are sound. And then if the app does have evidence, we ask people for factor three, think about, is it usable? Is it engaging? There's strong evidence that a lot of times people will download an app, but they'll never use it more than once. And certainly no mental health app, no matter how safe and how effective, is going to be useful if it's only used once. So we want to make sure that people find apps that are engaging, and we offer some questions to help people think about it. The last layer we call data sharing. We want to make sure that the data the app collects gets back to you and your clinical team in a meaningful way. You don't want to silo and fragment your mental health care data in some way that it can never be accessed by you or other people again. So we basically ask people, think about the privacy and the security, think about the evidence, think about the usability, think about the data sharing. And I said, we can't tell you app X is better than app Y because apps are different, people have different needs, they want to use apps in different ways, but we can at least have people begin to do more informed decision-making, asking the right questions about apps.
And on the Future Tense website, you'll find a link to the four-step evaluation model that John Torres just mentioned. I'm Anthony Fennell, this is Future Tense, and if you want to send me a message or leave a comment, you can find me on Twitter. At Anthony J. Fennell is my handle. Let's hear now from Professor Helen Christensen, Director of the Black Dog Institute at the University of New South Wales.
We've done quite a number of reviews of what is available on the App Store for things like suicide prevention, for people who have bipolar disorder, for depression. And what we've tried to do is see if those apps are actually consistent in the messages that they're giving with the scientific evidence about what works to improve depression or bipolar disorder or prevent suicide. And our findings are, as you might expect, that there are many, many apps out there, but very few of them are evidence-based. On the other hand, if you ask people who are living with bipolar disorder or suicide, they have their own array of apps, and pretty much none of those have been shown to be effective in the scientific literature. So you have this problem where people are using apps that they like and engage with and are possibly helpful, but our reviews of what's out there show that what's on the App Store is usually not really that good, and that the only trials that have been done on really good apps or shown to be effective are not used by consumers. So this is really a researcher problem and a consumer problem, if you know what I mean, that there's a kind of schism between what people like to use and what actually is left on the research desk because it isn't able to be translated into something that's useful to those who need it.
Which is curious, isn't it? Because you would imagine that if you've got a problem and you're seeking some sort of assistance, that you'd be looking for review for what is considered the best form of technology to use.
Yeah, and this is another thing that we've been looking at is what people want from apps. And usually what they want from apps are actually not provided by the apps, even the apps that they use, or only one part of what they need is provided by the app. I mean, we have to remember this is a very new field as well. Really, this explosion of apps is only in the last 3 or 4 years. But yes, we need to work harder in how we develop apps to be co-designed with people who need to use them, but also have been evaluated, at least in some fashion, to show that they're either consistent with what's a good thing to do, or we've actually done the trials to show that they work.
And are there ones that stand out that have been evaluated and shown to be effective?
So if we look at websites for a moment, because there's a lot more of those that have been evaluated, the one that I think is absolutely amazingly effective is something called ShutEye, which we did a trial of using about 1,150 Australians. And it's an app that we thought, if you used it, might actually prevent you from developing depression, but it does focus on your sleep. So essentially, it's an app designed to improve your sleep using behavioral medicine around sleep. And our findings were that it actually reduced suicide ideation and depression. There is a website which tries to pull together all the research evidence around particular websites and apps, which is at the Australian National University. It's called Beacon, and it can be searched by going Beacon Self-Help. It has the most amazing library of all the apps that have been subjected to scientific evidence, and it has a smiley face rating of those apps that have been found to be incredibly effective. Another example of a good app is one that Beyond Blue now supports for young kids' mental health. It's called Brave, and it's helping young kids who are anxious and depressed. And I think Beyond Blue has made it available free to the public to use. MooGym, of course, is an oldie, but it does actually work. At Black Dog, we have a website called My Compass, which also has an associated app, which has been shown to be effective in depression. We also have a program called Bite Back, which is a positive psychology site for young people. We really need to be focusing on the implementation of these apps. So at the moment, it's sort of free range. You know, you can go and find them and use them. But at Black Dog, we recognise that a systems approach is a much better way to integrate them into systems of care. So, for example, our My Compass app is being used in general practice now as part of a procedure that people do when they come into the waiting room, that they fill in an iPad which screens them, provides them with information, and when they see their doctor, the doctor can recommend, if they have symptoms of depression, different types of treatments that they can use. And one of those is an automated CBT program. So the idea is here that it's not just out there for people to find, but we're actually trying to integrate it into areas in which people with mental health problems or depression symptoms to reside, if you like. We know that 90% of people see their GP in a year. So this is a good place to, if you like, catch people and offer them an opportunity to do something like an online program that we know is well evaluated.
You wanna disappear in a crowd, just a stranger in a room.
I think that technology, when used in its best and highest purposes, can definitely be an asset to our mental health. My name is Amy Blankson. I'm the co-founder of GoodThink. And I've personally seen this in my own work. When I was writing The Future of Happiness, I tested out over 400 different apps and gadgets and devices, and several of them were promising things that I didn't feel like they delivered. But there were a number of really well-researched apps and gadgets and devices that were very useful. And one in particular was a device called the Spire Stone that was a small lava-shaped rock that clips onto your bra strap or your waistband, and it helps you to monitor your breathing. And naturally, I am actually a very anxious person. And so I thought that would be kind of fascinating to understand how my breath related to my outward activity. And so I was testing it out for about 5 days, and it was showing me some good trends. But on the fifth day, something fascinating happened. And my daughter, who is now 10 years old, she wound up breaking her neck in our backyard pool. And I'll just tell the listeners that she's completely fine today, thankfully. But at the time, it was really stressful for our family. And because I happened to be bearing the spire stone, I was tracking along how my breathing was responding over the course of the day. And what I found was that my breath was incredibly calm all the way through the end of the doctor's appointments where my daughter got fitted for this massive neck brace that she was going to have to wear all summer. And it wasn't until we were walking out of the hospital that my breathing began to speed up and the spire stone vibrated, sending a message to my phone that said, "Amy, you're feeling stressed." And I said, "I know." But what that did for me in that moment was it piqued an important moment for me that said, "Hey, what's going on here?" And by doing that sort of mini vibration that caught my attention, I learned something about myself and was able to change my behavior. And for me, that's technology at its finest. It's giving us insight into our own behavior with some aha moments and some data to back it up that says, this is not just the way I'm thinking I think I might feel. This is actually what's happening in my body. And here's what I can learn about myself as a result.
Which goes to the point that sometimes we're not as good as we think we are at picking up changes to the way we breathe, the way we feel, to our emotional state. And biometric tracking technologies can be a very simple way of keeping our physical and emotional balance.
We're going through what I call twin revolutions, meaning that we're going through a cognitive revolution and a technological revolution at the same time, where we're able to actually peel back the layers of our mind to see what's going on inside of us. And, you know, most of us are familiar these days with fitness trackers, which I think is the most well-accepted form of this sort of self-knowledge. But I think fitness trackers are just the beginning of wake up to understanding what's going on in our minds and our bodies. A few years ago, we would have kitschy mood rings that would say, you know, you're feeling warm, so therefore you're happy. But there was no science there. And then we had things like vitamins that came along where we would take this blanket pill hoping that it would make us somehow feel better. But now we're able to be so much more granular, looking in at our micro decisions that we make each day to change our behavior, to tweak it, to learn and to grow at an exponential rate. I would say that in the process of finding something that would help you gain this insight, number one is to identify what you are trying to learn about yourself. And then secondly, I'm going to pick one thing and not five things to try at once. At the height of my research phase, I literally was vibrating all over because I had so many wearables I was trying and my nightstand was billowing with wires and cords and chargers. And I think that that's almost the antithesis of what we're hoping for here. But I did that because I wanted readers and listeners and viewers to understand what it means to overdo it, as well as to very carefully and intentionally select something that is going to be a lifestyle change that you can sustain for the long run. The field is still very much emerging. And what we see coming out of the field are just the slew of apps that are throwing out great ideas to see what's most sticky and trying to marry together good research and science with good user interface. And I have to say, I don't think we're quite there yet for most of the apps that are out there for mood tracking. There are a number of apps that are starting to explore what that might look like, but I think that a lot of it relies upon self-report. So how are you feeling in this moment? And you might only feel motivated to report your mood when you're feeling good. So you might not get the full range of data. I was, however, recently at an emotional artificial intelligence conference at MIT, and I saw some really fascinating new trends that are emerging that are using facial recognition software to build into other types of devices that we already have, whether it be a television or our windows, or it could be in store displays, to track how we are responding to our environment using objective data. So it's able to capture what your emotion is, whether it's surprise or contempt, anger, joy, sadness, using 11,000 different points on your face. And I recognize that there are all kinds of ethical issues that are aligned with this that I think we need to proceed cautiously. But I am optimistic to see that having that kind of feedback could be transformative. And there's some interesting things that we can learn about ourselves through mood, both individually and as a group collectively, that I've seen some promising work emerging in the field.
Amy Blankson, author of The Future of Happiness and co-founder of the organisation GoodThink. Getting around that consistency of self-reporting problem that Amy just mentioned brings us back to the power and potential of social media. Having a television or shop window monitor your expression may seem intrusive and futuristic, but social media platforms already surveil us. So can they be adapted for purpose? Senior mental health researcher Bridianne O'Day believes they can. Her work suggests even the overuse of personal pronouns in a social media post, such as I and me, can be telling about a person's susceptibility to mental illness.
Psycholinguistic theory has shown us repeatedly that, in fact, the words that people use, not just the tone, in fact, the words they use and the way the words are placed together, can actually infer the psychological state of a person. There have been a number of studies that have shown links between the way we use our words and mood. However, mood tends to be quite self-reported. One example is someone might have shared in their social media comments that they are experiencing depression, and therefore we've taken that and classified that person as depressed. What we were really interested in looking at was what we call ground truth. So how do we actually validate whether this is a true marker, whether personal pronouns is a true marker? And what we found in this particular study is that, in fact, up to 30 to 60% of the variance in someone's mood can be predicted by these types of markers. And this is on par with other things that we could measure in a person, such as whether or not they're employed or their gender or these other factors. So the science so far is showing that these can be valid and reliable markers. The important thing to know is that it's looking like everybody has a different marker. So at the beginning of the research, we were thinking that, okay, wouldn't it be great if we could identify aspects of social media that we could monitor? And when we saw this marker, we could tell if somebody needed help. But what we found was that at a population level, these markers weren't particularly strong, so they were unlikely to be highly accurate. So we then started looking at individuals and their own posts and their own mood. And what we found was that each person seems to have a unique marker. So for example, we looked at the blog data of one particular user, and when they referred to money more often, that matched with their level of anxiety. So much so that if we simply monitored their blog for their mentions of money, we could in fact perhaps infer how anxious a person is feeling.
But that's going to be, as you say, that's going to be very specific to specific people, isn't it?
That's right. And when you have billions of Facebook users and social media users, if you're trying to monitor them in real time, that becomes quite a challenge for researchers. So what we're trying to do is look at the ways that you can automate those processes and trying to understand, okay, just how much data do we need to be able to detect a marker? So if you think about it, like we think about genetics, you know, and DNA, if we looked at that on social media, you know, how much posts do we need? Can we look at someone for maybe 2 weeks and then find out a marker? Or do we need to look at data over a 12-month period? And so that's where the science is heading.
But just because you can, as they say, doesn't mean you should. Not so long ago, Facebook came in for considerable criticism when it ran secret experiments to see whether it could accurately predict a person's mood from the posts that he or she made. They were doing it for marketing reasons, to make more money. But even doing it for altruistic reasons could be problematic, concedes Bridie O'Day.
So one of the prominent ethical issues with social media data is that users have not necessarily consented to their data being used for monitoring purposes. So most social media users are aware that their data is being used to deliver advertisements. And that seems to be generally accepted amongst Facebook and social media users. However, if we were to pose the question of how comfortable do you feel having your social media monitored for the purposes of mental health? We're not sure yet how everybody feels about that. There has been some research done in the UK which has shown that if it's for social good purposes, people tend to be open to having their social media data monitored. But as we also saw in the UK when they launched the Samaritans app, which was able to monitor your Twitter feed for suicidal posts, users were not very comfortable about having somebody else monitored and alerted about their posts. So at the moment, we sort of have a paradox between having the ability to monitor social media posts and perhaps detect risk to a certain degree of accuracy versus, okay, what does the audience expect? What do users actually expect? And unfortunately, if that's not handled carefully, it can have unintended consequences. We've seen reports in the media, we've seen anecdotal reports where users who have been detected on Facebook or Instagram and had authorities contact them, they found that to be a very unhelpful process. So at this point in time, we are still not sure on what is the best way to intervene when risk is detected. So it brings around the issues of, do people feel comfortable having their data monitored? What's the role of informed consent? And then, yes, when we can detect risk, who is in the best position to be intervening? And so they're two big ethical issues that researchers and companies, social media companies, are facing around mental health. And we've seen some studies emerge where companies, social media companies, have done, if you like, experiments on users to look at how exposures to certain types of content can influence mood. So one of the things that emerges out of this is trust. And we know that when you're experiencing a mental health issue and you may or may not wish to seek help, trust plays a very big role in who you will turn to. And therefore, myself as a mental health researcher, the Black Dog Institute as a mental health research organisation, we really need to think carefully about how much trust people have in using social media to detect and intervene for mental health purposes.
But do you see the possibility in the future of somebody who knows they have a problem, a mental health problem, might voluntarily agree to this kind of surveillance in order to help them come to terms or to spot the sort of problems which might lie ahead for them?
And we're definitely seeing that already. So we've actually conducted some studies which use a tracking device on your mobile phone, so it's able to glean your social media data, and it's able to use Bluetooth to determine who you connect to, GPS tracking and whatnot. And when we asked people, do they feel that their privacy has been breached in using this app, or do they feel that this sort of monitoring is somewhat invasive? Even though people may report that it does, because it's something that is helpful, it is there to support them, they seem to be more open to participating in these type of activities. So I certainly think that both now and in the future, even though we might think that this is an imposition, because it's for good mental health, it's for protective purposes, perhaps we might be more open to using these types of technology. But I think still we have to keep trust at the forefront of our minds and understand that if a person has a negative help-seeking experience, that can actually impair their help-seeking across the lifetime. So we really need to be careful on how we're approaching this with people.
Bridianne O'Day from the Black Dog Institute. And as I said at the end of last week's program, if you or someone you know needs help, you can always call Lifeline or Beyond Blue. A link to all of the sites and applications we've mentioned today can be found on the Future Tense website. Thanks to co-producer Karin Savanovitz and sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.